These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythm, just get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University. Welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, Cedric Robinson and the Precepts of Black Studies with Josh Myers. Africa World Now Project is next. Black life, that is, the range of thought and behavior of Africana peoples, has been the foundation upon which the modern world was built. It, too, has been the foundation upon which the modern world centers its systems and institutions of disdain, often collapsing anything that is seen to be other into its limited definitions of blackness. For many of us, black life can be primarily understood as an articulation of maroonage, a resistance to the dialectical processes of existing and non-existing in the warped imagination of whiteness. To understand the complexities and simplicities of black life, to see the constant manifestations of the refusal to be dehumanized, we must push the way we think about black life, identifying and mapping the improvisational processes that produce polyrhythmic ways of being, which is the primary essence of black life. Ways of being that ultimately is a refusal to fit into narrowly constructed categories of racist thought, mostly actualized, not even on purpose. Moton suggests that black studies must always maintain its relationship with black study, as it is black study that refreshes lines of rigorous anti-disciplinary invention, effecting intellectual renewal against academic sterility. Black studies is the insurrectionary project of black life. For Moton, study is what you do with other people. It's talking and walking around with other people, working, dancing, suffering, some irreducible convergence of all three held under the name of speculative practice. The notion of a rehearsal, being in a kind of workshop, playing in a band, in a jam session, or old men sitting on a porch, or people walking together in a factory. There are these various modes of activity. The point of calling it study is to mark that the insistent and irreversible intellectuality of these activities is already present. It is this already present that Josh Myers has provided an important mediation on study, outside inside the university, an exploration of the radical praxis of black life. Today, we present a recent talk that Josh Myers presented titled Cedric Robinson and the Precepts of Black Studies. In addition to being a member of the Africa World Now Project Collective, Josh Myers is an associate professor of Africana Studies in the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. He is the author of We Are Worth Fighting For, A History of the University Student Protests of 1989, and the recently released Cedric Robinson, The Time of the Black Radical Tradition, as well as editor of A Gathering Together literary journal. His research interests include Africana intellectual histories and traditions, Africana philosophy, musics, and food ways, as well as critical university studies and disciplinarity. His work has been published in Critical Ethnic Studies Journal, the Journal of African American Studies, the Journal of Pan-African Studies, the African Journal of Rhetoric, the Human Rights and Globalization Law Review, Liberator Magazine, Global African Worker, Pamazuka, and Burning House Press, among other literary spaces. His current book project, Of Black Study with Pluto Press, is set to be released in January 2023. Of Black Study explores how the ideas of black intellectuals created different ways of thinking and knowing in their pursuit of conceptual and epistemological freedom. Of Black Study explores the work of thinkers who broke with racial and colonial logics of academic disciplinarity. Bookended by meditations on June Jordan and Tony Cade Bambara, Josh focuses on how W.E.B. Du Bois, Sylvia Winter, Jacob Carruthers, and Cedric Robinson contributed to Black Studies approaches to knowledge production within and beyond Western structures of knowledge. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities in Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corbury's and Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
Thank you to all that had a hand in bringing me to Binghamton for the second time this year already. Andy and the Departments of Sociology and others. Last time I was here, it was for, don't mess this up, Human Development Working Group. Close. And it was actually a few months after the book came out. The book came out in November 2021. So I was here in March 2022. And I think it was the first time I was in person for that particular book, in person convening for that particular book. So it's nice to be back, and since I'm back, it must be because I did something right. So I'll try to repeat that today. Yesterday we were up at SUNY Cortland doing the same exact talk, and in that talk it was also a class that attended. It was an Introduction to African American Studies class. And so I'm happy to have students, again, attending a talk on this particular topic. I am primarily a teacher. So should I do something to mute? Or should it? Just leave it? Okay. I'm primarily a teacher, so I love to talk about this with students. And, you know, sometimes academics get together and have, you know, these high-flying theoretical conversations. But I hope that this book and my next book resonate with students too. So I was told that you all are thinking about racial capitalism and the idea of racial capitalism. So what I'll do to start today is read a little bit from the forthcoming book. So nobody has heard this before except for my editors. My understanding of Cedric's work with respect to racial capitalism and how Cedric's works fit into that particular frame. So the section of the book that this is from the chapter on Cedric Robinson. The book is composed of four mini intellectual biographies and two meditations. The four mini intellectual biographies are, of course, one is on Cedric. The other three are on Sylvia Winter, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Jacob Carruthers. The two meditations are on Tony Cade Bambara and June Jordan. Ooh. So, the poets and the writers, very near. In fact, my next book is a poetry collection, so I won't do any poetry today, unless I want. Okay. But this is from the Cedric chapter, and it's called Of Order. This word, order, right? It's the word that we use a lot, right? It's a huge word in Cedric Robinson's work. And so this section is called The Order of Racial Capitalism. The Order of Racial Capitalism. So I'm going to read that and see what that sparks, and then we can talk a little bit about why I titled today's talk Cedric Robinson and the Precepts of Black Studies. In 1994, Cedric Robinson joined several scholars at Stanford University invited by Sylvia Winter to discuss the significance of the work of Harold Cruse in the wake of both the increasing prominence of black scholarship in the academy and the increasing vulnerability of black life in the world. Robinson's paper, entitled Towards Fascism? Race, the Two Reservations, and the Materiality of Theory,
elaborated the ongoing evolution of racial capitalism while placing hope in the recent uprisings of black folk in the ghettos, folk who needed no direction from academics, a group who could only, quote, help it along, end quote. In a moment where fascism threatened, the histories of black resistance were critical in black studies' quest to generate, quote, a native theory of transformation, end quote. In a draft version of this paper, he described what he had meant by racial capitalism, a concept he had put forth 11 years earlier. Racial capitalism, Cedric Robinson wrote, is a system of production and exploitation whose natural development propels the social categories of class and achieves its epistemological justifications in the creeds of individualism and logical positivism. Modern capitalism, however, assumed its historical character within the race epistemes consequent to slave economies among Europeans, and much later instituted by Europeans. Race orderings, which in the 19th century race sciences extended to females, ruptured the calculi of capitalism, suborning class, liberalism, and scientific discourse. And I believe that the persistence of race wars all over Europe confirms the antiquity of these epistemes. This is one of the rare places where Cedric Robinson defines racial capitalism. And so I pick it back up, and I say racial capitalism had deeper origins and more consequential foundations than what theorists had linked to the conditions of the modern era. And this is why Robinson could conclude that, quote, its natural end was fascism, end quote. Black cultures of resistance were our only hope, for we had intervened before. If the idea of the black radical tradition had been misunderstood, then the idea of racial capitalism has been both misunderstood and hotly contested. At stake in many of these discussions are considerations of whether or not capitalism, is the source of racism. If it is, then the route to cleansing the world of racism and racialism is a clear one. If it is not, then questions of a post-capitalist future are fraught with danger, compromised by the continuity of racial inequality and racialist thinking. And then there are those who view these issues a bit more flexibly, taking a middle ground position, asserting that while capitalism may not be racism's origin, we should nevertheless privilege anti-capitalist strategies as pathways to erecting anti-racist societies. Whether racism is inherent to Western society determines how radical thinkers and their liberal counterparts imagine the future, or what is to be done in the present. In their hands, racial capitalism is a tool to critique economic exploitation and racism and their co-articulation. Connected to the debates about racial capitalism are historical subfields that have begun to reinterrogate the nexus between slavery and capitalism, the history of racial inequality, as well as the racial critiques of various iterations of organized Marxism. This conversation, of course, is not limited to historians. Others in many different fields have taken the conceptual foundations of racism in the modern world as cues for studying its contemporary meaning and impact, all the while never forgetting to remind us of its social constructedness. Within this work, most commentators have sought to analyze the ways that peoples of African descent and other race populations have had their lives upended by white supremacy and how they have understood, struggled, and resisted this incursion. In recent years, these studies cite Robinson and racial capitalism almost as a matter of course. And there is now a growing, if not mature, discourse that offers racial capitalism as a necessary beginning point to theorize our moment. Why does Edgerome want me to connect? I'm not here. Everywhere I go, Edgerome says hello. But that is usually when the engagements end. This work mostly examines questions of race as a modern problem, and usually in the United States context. Liberal articulations of race and racism tend to associate both within the constellation of material and psychic processes. Racism is embedded in the American soul. In these framings, race is seen as a limit to collective advancement. Studies of racial capitalism become another variation of Negro problem studies, resulting in an intellectual practice that contains humans within racial logics even when it struggles against them. A vision of the future world, the arguments go, is one where we achieve racial progress through anti-racist intervention that would heal a divided country. This idea of progress is assumed at the same time that there is the possibility of regression, which must be avoided at all costs. That is, capitalist modernity has to be seen as either inevitable or progressive, but at all times capable of being improved through anti-racism. Inequalities can be made equal. Disparities can be addressed with public policy, better laws, and changed hearts and minds. That's the liberal side. Well, there's also the left, right? When the white left is not congratulating itself for belatedly and hesitatingly having a racial analytic at all, they argue that race is simply a modern construct that was only relevant with the appearance of capitalism and eradicable, not through liberal intervention, but through worker struggles. Black leftist thought has traditionally shared variations of this position, but has also attempted to move beyond race as the primary or only signifier for black political expressions in order to reveal the ways that black elite articulations of the problem tended to obscure the materialist foundations of racism. For these thinkers, a radical politics constituted the ability to see the problems with black bourgeoisie dreams of progress. The black left continues to vociferously attack the liberal concern with disparities, arguing that equality is a false promise under a class system. Further, their argument broadens racial capitalism to a global question. America is not a moral authority with a broken wing. It is a global hegemon that utilizes race to establish imperial power. Racial exploitation secures these ends, which are material, this worldly necessities. Blackness is an economic category. Racial progress entails the eradication of exploitive conditions. We defeat race by defeating capitalism. We defeat race by defeating imperialism. Racial capitalism is nothing but conceptual language to understand this war. In sum, whether as a byproduct of capitalism or otherwise, race has to be seen as consonant with capitalism. It is simply presumed that it is in capitalism that we live and move and have our being. And it is in capitalism, only in capitalism, that blackness makes sense. We may struggle, but we may not imagine a world beyond what the modern is and has been. So, there are elements of Robinson's work that find resonance with many of the current usages of racial capitalism on the left. In his final book, Forgeries of Memory and Meaning, probably his magnum opus in my opinion, often not read as such, he offers the idea of the racial regime to understand the evolution of racial capitalism in the modern world. These racial regimes were constructed social systems in which race is proposed as a justification for the relations of power. That's a quote from the book, Forgeries of Memory and Meaning. It was the creation of a constellation of forces of state and industry which together produced and reproduced racialized discourses and popular imagery within the arts and entertainment spaces that reaffirmed black and non-white life as inferior, as abject creatures in need of control. But these mythic discourses, as much as they masqueraded as truth, are unstable, always subject to exposure, which also makes the racial regime hostile and always interested in its own maintenance. The demands of industry need the racial regime to be continuously updated as it faces unique challenges in the world. Yet, his conception of racial capitalism is after something more. For Robinson, the point was never to adjudicate a debate between liberal anti-racists who merely wanted to reform capitalism and socialists who believe the abolition of race would come with the abolition of capitalism. Neither was it to participate in some Hegelian exercise about capitalist modernity's evolution and eventual flowering in the West. Racial capitalism was an attempt to explain questions of order and how order came to construct and rely upon human differences. And it was theorized during a period in Robinson's larger work attempted to unpack the meaning of power, the ability to create certain kinds of meaning, to justify certain ways of ordering society. The deployment of this view of racial capitalism was neither an evasion of political struggle, nor was it the endorsement of either side of the often false binaries erected in many of the struggles between materialists and idealists, race first or class first analyses, and others. It was about whole structures of thought, whole structures of being. While there have been critiques of Robinson's actual argument, much of the contested nature of what constitutes racial capitalism does not proceed by way of engaging how or why Robinson employed the term. Racial capitalism, if you follow Robinson's thinking, became a way to see the ways that racism was bound up with capitalism, not merely because of some economic rationale, but because it was necessarily connected to the ways humanity was perceived in European life. Of course, the quote from Black Marxism, first page of the chapter on racial capitalism, page 9. The historical development of world capitalism was influenced in a most fundamental way by the particularistic forces of racism and nationalism. This could only be true if the social, psychological, and cultural origins of racism and nationalism both anticipated capitalism in time and formed a peace with those events that contributed directly to its organization of production and exchange. As a historical force, that was the end of the quote, as a historical force and an enduring form of European social order, racism was particular not to an era, but to the civilization itself. That last part was a Robinson quote as well. At the core of Robinson's use of history was an emphasis on relations of power, which relied on the question of who could constitute definitions of the human. Clearly, these systems of power and control were not solely products of capitalism, but of a religious and feudal order that could be found at the very birth of the idea of Europe, itself a construction of different polities held together by conceptual systems that reified human difference as useful mechanisms for social order. Racial capitalism is both product of the very specific modern era and the residue of a long view genealogy. Like Winter, Sylvia Winter, Robinson located the origins of the propensity to differentiate long before the introduction of the African subject. It began as an internal matter, but not an eternal matter, an internal matter. And so that concludes the reading part of that. Why the title Cedric Robinson and the Precepts of Black Studies? For those who may have this book, the collection of essays published by Pluto Press, Cedric Robinson on Racial Capitalism, Black Internationalism, and Cultures of Resistance, was edited by H.L.T. Kwan, one of Cedric's students. You will notice that there's a chapter called David Walker and the Precepts of Black Studies. In that chapter, Robinson argues that if we are going to have founding texts or founding narratives or founding traditions, which all disciplines have, even though a lot of them are false, right? Like Aristotle wasn't doing political science. I mean, you can appropriate them, of course, just like sociology is appropriated Marx as a founder, right? It's nice. Follow the whole trajectory, though. My most recent book is about discipline, so I like talking about them, you know. But they appropriate people, right? Who does Black Studies appropriate? It's not as clear. So in 97, Cedric Robinson went to Ohio State and didn't get into Duke, and he gave this talk on David Walker and said that maybe we should kind of appropriate David Walker for Black Studies. It would give a lot of clarity to what we should be doing. Because what did David Walker stand for? Is this abolitionist guy who was from Wilmington, North Carolina, born free, but his father was born enslaved, right? in North Carolina, the free black community was essentially told to get out. We can't have y'all living side by side, enslaved people, right? And so once you were manumitted in North Carolina, you were given a set time to just leave, or they would re-enslave you. Fortunately, Walker doesn't get re-enslaved, even though he was never enslaved in the first place, but he does leave eventually. And he travels to the South Carolina, in fact, first, and he goes to Charleston. And it is speculated that he's in Charleston at the time that Denmark Vesey is planning the revolt in 1822, a major revolt, a planned revolt. Everybody knows what happens in 2015 when Dylann Roof goes into a church and massacres those 9 church members. But do we know that? There's a reason he chose that church in particular. It wasn't a random church. It was the church that Denmark Vesey used to plan the revolt in 1822. And so people speculate that David Walker was there. Nevertheless, he ends up in Boston, and he joins the abolitionist community, the black abolitionist community in particular, as an agent of Freedom's Journal, which is the first newspaper founded by black people in the United States, 1828. He joins the General Colored Association, a black abolitionist organization in Boston. And he sits down and he writes. He was literate, and we don't necessarily know how he became literate. He was probably educated by Quakers. But Walker uses his literacy to advance a number of political and cultural theories about this question of anti-slavery and abolition. First thing he says is, if we actually study human history, let's sit down and study this, right? Which is like one of the key planks of black studies, study. Right, this is one of the reasons Robinson says we have to appropriate Walker, because he studied stuff first before he talked. No, it's about study. It's about the act of taking words and taking texts and coming up with ways of engaging and spreading and, you know, advancing knowledge. I mean, that's really what we should do. In a moment of crisis, David Walker says, we got to study. He says, look, if you study, you will realize that there's no system of slavery that has ever existed, probably hyperbolic, but we'll use this hyperbole, but there's no system of slavery that has ever existed that denied the humanity of the enslaved, that called them animals, that called them real estate, that called them pieces of property, which makes American slavery or Western slavery the most, as he says, abject and cruel system that has ever existed. And to make matters worse, Christians are doing it. Walker, who's an evangelical Christian, he cannot wrap his head around how you can read the Bible, become a follower of Jesus Christ, and also be a slaveholder. It doesn't make sense to him. His ethical foundations then are in a liberation theology reading of Christianity that had never existed within the United States at that point. Even the most firebrand theologians, Jonathan Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, slaveholder. And so this emergence of a figure who not only has the audacity to call out the hypocrisy of American Christianity, but then to say that redemption of this particular country and this particular theological and religious tradition will only come through black people, then says that black folk, the best way to make this happen is revolt. He says God will raise up a Hannibal. And that's the reading of his global history, right? He says it's only going to take revolt. And by openly calling for a revolt, and at the same time saying that through revolt, we can redeem anything that's good about the American ethos and creed, he not only advances what might be a founding tradition in black studies, he also knew that by such a call, he was calling for the end of his own life.
What might be a founding tradition?
Okay. What's going on? Y'all help me. Should I mute this person? You got, you're handling this. Okay. So we don't have this technology at Howard yet, so I don't know. Or we do have it, I never used it before. Anyway, this founding tradition, this founding narrative, also knew is what got David Walker possibly killed, right? He even says this in the appeal. I don't know if I said the title of the book. He wrote this out in a book called The Appeal. That was, you know, surreptitiously sewn into the linings of coats. He was a tailor by trade. He sold the books into the linings of coats, and used a network of black sailors to disseminate the books all throughout the United States South on plantations. So all you needed was one person or two people who were literate, and their jobs were to go from plantation to plantation and read the appeal out loud to enslaved people. Now, that might sound like black folk or people who are working need inspiration, or they need to learn about their condition. But what Cedric Robinson says about this is Walker was only given voice to what they already believed. This wasn't an idea of, you know, a leadership position in, you know, the vanguard, whatever you want to call it, right? Walker was simply given voice to what they already believed, right? Sometimes, as I said yesterday, sometimes we need to be reminded of what we already know and what we already feel. Somebody has to give voice to something that's already within you, right? That's essentially what happens. And there's speculation that one of the peoples that heard David Walker was another evangelical Christian who lived in a place called Southampton County, Virginia, by the name of Nat Turner. Now, that's speculation. We don't know for sure. But if there's an inkling of truth to that, imagine the power in thinking of words as the conduit for this revolutionary action and activity. And then imagine that that's what black studies should exist for. These are the precepts of black studies. And so Robinson, in as much as he labels David Walker as someone who could provide a founding narrative or a founding text, a founding tradition in black studies, my work argues that Cedric Robinson also can constitute someone who offers a founding narrative, a founding text, and a founding tradition for black studies. So that's why I titled this talk Cedric Robinson in the Precepts of Black Studies. That's why I have a chapter on Cedric Robinson in my book of black study. What will be black studies' relationship to the concept of order that Robinson so beautifully elaborates in all of his work? In other words, as an intellectual discipline that was created out of insurgency of black students, how do you relate to those systems that are in place that establish order, that manage our lives, that control our lives, which, by the way, other disciplines were erected to maintain? That's essentially what I try to argue in this next book. Should I stop there, or should I keep going? I mean, there's more I can say, or should we have a conversation, or should I keep going?
Keep going?
Keep going? All right. So, 2012, I wrote an article, an early treatment of Cedric Robinson's relationship to black studies, an article called The Scholarship of Cedric J. Robinson, Methodological Considerations for Africana Studies. If you hear me say Africana studies and black studies, I'm using those two interchangeably. And so I argue in that article, there are six things that Cedric Robinson's work does, right? That make black studies folks, that should make black studies folks pay attention in terms of developing a new or a different or an appropriate methodology for how to do work in our discipline, which is really an anti-discipline, if you think about it. The first thing that Robinson does is we got to start by understanding where we are. And so if you look at his books, there's a lot of stuff that's on Europe, right? There's a lot of stuff that's on the idea of the West. He's one of the sharpest thinkers on the development of
the European political and social order. And a lot of my students don't want to start there, which is fine. Right? You come to Black Studies, you come to do Black Studies, right? But we can't understand where we are without starting where we are. It's almost like it's a maneuver to displace the authority of Western thought in our lives, right? And so it's not enough to make a claim against Eurocentricity without understanding the idea or the concept of Europe itself. And so he does that not only in Black Marxism, he does that in Forgeries of Memory and Meaning. The book starts in Elizabethan England, which is, like, for most people, extremely boring. I don't want to talk about Shakespeare again. Please. But Robinson's kind of like a Shakespearean thinker. Like, let's navigate Shakespeare a little bit. Right? Does the same thing when it comes to understanding the development of the church and the secular authorities that appropriate the idea of charisma. Some of his most fascinating work is around this idea of charisma, which, as you all know, sociologists, right, was a major feature of Max Weber's intellectual work. What Robinson says is, whereas Weber talks about the bureaucracy and the appropriation of charisma by political elites, Robinson makes the argument that it's not the charisma that's the problem. Charisma is great. Right? Charismatic expectation was one of the things that allows people to see themselves in the most divine light. And then people use that experience to then transform their lived experiences. And they develop a relationship to God and to the Creator that becomes a useful guide for how to be human in the world. It's not charisma that's the problem. It's the appropriation of charisma that's the problem by people who aren't concerned with human flourishing. What are they concerned with? Order. If I can take something that's transformative out of its context and use it to enslave you, then I can establish what we call the political world, political society. And so it is Robinson's understanding of the very origin of political order that gives him the foundation to then say, well, this is what resistance has to look like. Ain't gonna be no inside job. We're not gonna become the president and all of a sudden liberate ourselves. And so this thorough understanding of the West is at the core of his methodology. The second thing that I said in 2012 that's at the core is this notion that that system is not all powerful. It's a beautiful formulation, right? Because we talk about systems so much and the way that they impose themselves on us, like oppressed peoples, exploited peoples. We struggle against systems every day. Sometimes we don't even notice that we're struggling against those systems, right? But they're not all powerful. In fact, we know that they aren't all powerful because in imposing themselves, they're imposing themselves because they don't even have faith that they can maintain the status quo. That's what war is about. You need to fight a war against an already passive people. That's why the United States military budget is so large, because they know at some point the center will not hold, because it's built on a fiction. Imperialism was never meant to last. Colonialism was never meant to last, except in the ideas of those who are in power. But there are the people. And Robinson did a lot of work of understanding the people. Small p. The people who resist. The people who say no. The people for whom we should live and write for. The people who should guide us in our understanding of the world. They are the ones that we have to understand, because they never accepted that this system was all there is, that it was all powerful, that we could never
defeated, right? I mean, this is how we know Afro-pessimism is a scholarly thing, right? You can't convince average people of Afro-pessimism, right? We're slaves. Y'all know what Afro-pessimism is? I'm sorry. No? Don't worry about it. This is an academic idea. Ordinary people don't believe that. One of the other section titles that I could have read from is a section called Ordinary Life. And I talk about it in this book too, The Intellectual Biography. Cedric came from ordinary people. And he never lost that sensibility. And they expected, you know, him to, you know, go to school and do well and succeed. But they also expected him to have a real relationship to people. And so that never leaves his understanding. If you read the preface of Black Marxism, it says this is about a people's struggle. It's not about academic theory, you know, that's cute. This is about a people's struggle. You don't see a lot of books produced out of the logics of academic and university life that break from that authority and say, this is about people. Small p. And so it leads to my third consideration, and that is to really understand those peoples. The community itself is the origin of inquiry, right? And so research methodologies often have what we call inductive or deductive reasoning, and there's a way that one brings a particular kind of baggage to the research environment. What I think Robinson his work signifies is start from the idea of community and then proceed. Start from what communities do. And what do communities do? They try to perpetuate themselves. They try to survive. They try to live for a certain, as Du Bois said, a certain set of ideals. In the social sciences, we bring a set of ideals to those communities. And we look for evidence of them, right? How do they approach the question of democracy? Okay, so just stop. Do they have a word for that in their language, even? I mean, so Robinson, this is sort of speaks to his background in anthropology. Because when he was in undergrad, anthropology, which has a lot of problems in terms of the colonial and exploitative systems that it supported, right? But when he was in college in 1958 through 1963, anthropology was the only discipline where you could find non-white people. And so he drops his pre-med major and says, I want to study this. And thankfully, there were radical people in Berkeley's anthropology department that understood the colonial history of anthropology, right? And so it was with caution that he goes into anthropology. At the same time, there's a radical criminology movement coming out of Berkeley. So it is with caution that he goes into these particular spaces, right? And because of that radical tradition within those disciplines, Robinson never really becomes someone who worships at the altar of disciplinarity. Because the disciplines themselves aren't the thing to be maintained. It's about a people's struggle. And so if a discipline can help me, I'm going to use it, but most of the time it's not really going to help. Disciplines exist to help themselves. It's like activity for the sake of activity. So when he goes to graduate school in political science, he tells his teachers, I'm going to actually try to destroy this discipline from the inside out. And they're like, ha ha ha, that's funny. And then he tries to do it. And it's like, wait a minute. You said you were going to do this, but we didn't believe you. Well, we can't necessarily allow you to. And he says, yes, you can. Because this is about a people struggle. Right? Why would I be in the academy if I'm not doing this kind of work? And so he has to end up, you know, threatening them with a lawsuit before he's allowed to pass the dissertation, which
I think one of the reasons he doesn't get tenure at Binghamton, I'm only speculating here, is that they never forgave him for not having his PhD. Because he only gets it in 1980, after he's gone from here. He had finished his dissertation 1973, long before he even got here. I'm sorry, 1975. Well, that makes my theory wrong. So let me just erase that. So he got his PhD in 75, but it was a struggle. When he came here, he didn't have his PhD. And so the tenure fight may have had something to do with that, but he did get his PhD in 75. So I'm still trying to figure out why he didn't get tenure for real. I did find a letter from Professor Wallerstein in C.L.R. James's papers in New York, asking C.L.R. James to write a 10-year letter for Cedric Robinson. I don't know if C.L.R. James followed up or not. If C.L.R. James did follow up and he did write a letter on behalf of Cedric Robinson, I don't know how that would have been received on his 10-year committee at Binghamton at the time. Again, one can only speculate. You know, it's probably in somebody's papers at home. We'll find out soon. But he did have his PhD, so I missed that part of the timeline up. The fourth consideration is that time, and this is something that I talk about a lot in this book, time is about relationships more than it is about abstract measurement. Okay? Time is about relationships more than it is about abstract measurement. How we experience time is more meaningful when we do away with things like the clock. Some of y'all have experienced that before, right? Sometimes when you're having a great lecture and a great time in class discussion, you're shocked when it's time to go. Is it already time to go? And then when it's the opposite, when there's no relationship happening, right, you're looking at your watch. All right, I'm not experiencing time in the way that I want to experience time here. I'm ready to go, right? And so we talked about this a lot the last time I was here. In fact, several questions about it. Part of what Robinson argues is that historical time doesn't determine meaning for Black people. What determines meaning is what we do within the boundaries of historical time. Which means that we all have a relationship, or we should have a relationship, to experiences that happened 200, 300, 400 years ago if we understand how to relate. If we understand what is consistent across those abstract measures of time. One of the things that's consistent is the Black radical tradition. So it doesn't matter if you're talking about the 19th century and the Haitian Revolution, or the 15th century, or the 21st century. The meaning of the Black radical tradition is consistent across those abstract measures of time. And so I say in the article, genealogy contextualizes chronology. We can't throw away the abstract measures, not yet, right? Even though the French and the Haitians tried to, right? Year one, I love that. It's now year one, revolution has started. You know, and so in Haiti, what year is it? It's like 226? 227, they actually still put that on their official documents too. They don't put 2022, that's for the West. For us, it's year 220-something. Because we're gonna start time based on when we became free. Number five, and this is one that's actually related to the earlier ones, right? Exemplars. And so I've been really fascinated with the use of exemplars, meaning people who represent the ideals. Sometimes there are a lot of folk who are not in archives, their names at least aren't in archives. And so we can't always talk about collective communities. And so we have to talk about people that represent those communities. But it's tricky because sometimes we too can get involved in this sort of great man theorization, right? Sometimes, and this has happened, you know, with my journeys, talking about Cedric Robinson,
we end up talking about Cedric Robinson to the exclusion of the tradition, to the exclusion of the community. No, let's not do that, right? Exemplars are only representatives. And in fact, I like Robinson's own formulation. Genius comes from the people. It's derivative of the people. And so I like to make this point because a lot of people talk about part three of Black Marxism, right? Why does he only focus on W.E.B. Du Bois, C.L.R. James, and Richard Wright? And I'm like, you have to read the section before. And he says, the point is that their genius is derivative. Not that they were the smartest people or they're the only ones, right? Their genius is derivative. Which means, the point is again, it's about a people's struggle. And he critiques the three of them. He says, they struggle to reach the genius that is already present and extant among the Black radical tradition. That's what Du Bois' life is about. Trying to get back to that grounding, to that foundational pursuit. That's what C.L.R. James' life is about. And he very much struggles to get there, right? He starts off as a Victorian. How does a Victorian write a book like Black Jacobins? He has to realize what was already around him. And so, it's not about elevating individual exemplars. It's about using exemplars to tell deeper and more important and significant stories about people. The people. Then finally, as I kind of gestured into earlier, the scholar is bone of the bone and flesh of the flesh. This is a formulation from Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk, right? Where he says that in order to really understand, right, what is happening with Black people, we have a vantage point because we're bone of the bone and flesh of the flesh. And Black studies, as June Jordan so beautifully said, you know, Black studies looks different from people who are bone of the bone and flesh of the flesh. And it's not a racial or class position. It's a position of relationships. I know he's using a biological metaphor, right? Bone and flesh. But he's talking about relationship. Because if John Brown was sitting right here, we would know you're bone of the bone and flesh of the flesh of those who live within this tradition, right? As Du Bois would say. This is about who we're related to. In fact, John Brown takes up a lot of the essence of Black abolitionism, right? He breaks from a lot of the white abolitionists. The beautiful story that William King tells and other folks tell, John Brown goes to Canada and he meets with the Black expatriate community, including Harriet Tubman and including Martin Robinson Delaney, right? And he says, this is my plan. And the Black expatriate community says, okay, let's do it, right? This ain't about individual genius. It's about a collective people's struggle. So those are the six methodological considerations that I think Black Studies has to take up in order to continue to struggle as an anti-discipline, right? Or a discipline that's not like other disciplines. A discipline that's about this question of human liberation. So with that said, Robinson has a lot to say about Black studies specifically. There are many things that I would point to, but since we're at Binghamton, in 1975 or six, right after the founding of the Fernand Braudel Center, Robinson presents a piece called Social Movements and the African Diaspora to the leadership, which included himself, of the Braudel Center. And in this proposal, he outlines several things. The first is the core periphery idea, which was so central at that time to world systems theory, has to be extended to include the idea that there is and there are political, social, and cultural movements within the periphery that also has something to say about the world system. He proposes that the Braudel Center take up this as an intellectual and research question. What do they already know about the conditions that they face? Before we say what we are going to say about how they are related to the world system, what do they already know? And in saying that, Robinson argues that part of the answer to that question is to contribute, world systems theorists, to the ongoing work of thinking through Africana and Black studies. Because Black studies can give you methodologies to further address and extend world systems theory around these particular questions. Okay? Social movements, meaning the ways in which people struggle against the system that we know are not all powerful, are a necessary component in understanding the world system. Why? Because part of the maintenance of the world system is their knowledge that people are not going to accept its imposition lying down, which is why anthropology is created, right? We need to know about their human culture so that we can more effectively colonize them, right? And so what kind of knowledges are produced out of anthropology, but what kind of knowledges can those who are in world systems theory, who are also trying to destroy the world system in some respects, right? Not just study it. In fact, Terry Hopkins says that. It's not about just studying, it's about transforming, right? He says this is a transgressive, I think he's the word, a transgressing discipline. And so we can't appropriate or re-articulate what anthropologists and sociologists are doing because they are about maintaining that system. And so Robinson steps in and says, okay, if you want to transgress, Black studies is there for you. Black studies is available for you. And the second thing that he proposes is that what we have to understand primarily is the relationship between the organized Marxist left and the development of the communist parties in the United States South among Black people. Because that's the last time working class Black people embraced organized Marxism. What did they do? How did they do it? How did this happen? This is 1975. I don't know what happened, and so maybe someone who has some memory of that is listening. But neither of those proposals ever went forth. 3 years later, Robinson doesn't get tenure and ends up at University of California, Santa Barbara. And World Systems takes on a lot of different and nuanced approaches in the interim. But we are left wondering what might have happened had Robinson been able to stay here in Binghamton. So that's the question I'm still pursuing. And I hope that maybe someone might have some insight. I think I can stop.
That's it for Africa Woke Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africawoknowproject@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. Instagram at Africa Woke Now Project. Access to our other media platforms can be reached through the bios of our social media. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa Woke Now Project Collective consists of international media journalists, executive producer and human rights activist Muwiza Muntali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funa Ngonda, senior research content contributor and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, content contributor and filmmaker Kurt Waterson, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technologies, and creative directors, international creative and artist designer Tabassum Siddiqui and Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project can be heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on all podcast platforms. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.